Bandwidth for MacBreak Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Welcome to MacBreak Weekly. I am Scott Bourne, filling in for Leo Laporte, and this is episode number 4. Joining me this week on MacBreak Weekly, we have Kenji Kato from Pixelcore, Mr. Chris Breen from Macworld. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Scott.
And Merlin Mann from 43folders.com, one of the most popular blogs in the world. Hi, Merlin.
How's it going, Scott?
Good. And joining us for the first time on MacBreak Weekly is digital photography expert and aperture author extraordinaire, Mr. Ben Long. First up, it seems like the world is shifting. Dr. Eric Schmidt from Google is joining Apple's board of directors. Kenji, what is going on?
That's a good question. You know, Apple's got some interesting people on their board of directors, and this is an interesting move in some ways. I mean, you've got people like Al Gore already on their board of directors, but this one seems like an interesting synergy. Could it potentially be that Google and Apple have something going on, or is it that they're just looking for a high-powered person for the board? It's hard to say right now.
Is it possible that this is an alliance against Microsoft?
Potentially. I mean, you've got Google, they've got their video, they've got all their search information, you know, they've got potentially all this dark bandwidth, they've got all these different things going on in the background, and whether you see them up front or not. And it will be interesting to see how he affects Apple and the direction that things go. I mean, typically it doesn't look like the board has much direction control day to day on Apple. We'll see if it has some kind of influence.
Let me bring Chris Breen in from Macworld Magazine. Chris, this kind of took me by surprise. Did you get any inkling of this before it was announced?
No, I didn't, but I'm not sure that he's going to have a lot of influence, just like most of the other board members don't have a lot of influence. If you look at Apple, they've got Al Gore on the board, and yet there's been a report recently that Apple's environmental policies are not exactly sterling. So it's not like Alice pulled Steve aside and said, you know, I think we need to be a greener company. And then they've got the head of the Quicken folks on there. And Quicken 2007 just came out for the Mac, and it's not universal binary. And so you sort of look at these sort of decisions with these people on the board, you wonder how much influence they really have in day-to-day operations.
Well, from what I understand, nobody has any influence in Apple other than Steve Jobs, so probably not a big deal, but it does cause one to ponder the possibilities with all these alliances being framed around potential competition for Microsoft. We'll see what happens. I want to keep things moving with you, Chris. There is a new tool for streaming the contents of your iTunes library from one computer to another, and you know something about it because you're the master at Playlist Mag in addition to Macworld. What can you tell us about MusicCast?
Well, MusicCast is a new software application from Andrew Kazmierski and Mark Davis, and Andrew actually invented Delicious Library as a kid. And this is an $18 application that lets you share your iTunes library via web browser. Now, this stuff exists in other forms. There's a Windows utility that allows you to stream your music from an iPod across the web. And there are other ways to share your music. But what this does is it sort of strips away the pretense and allows you to easily not only share your iTunes library, but also copy music from other people's iTunes libraries onto your computer. It's all web-based. The application is really simple to set up. Basically, you're just opening a port in your router that allows people to be able to see what's on your computer. You can either have them sign in and tell you who they are or not. They can come in anonymously. What they're trying to do is kind of intersect music sharing and social networking. The only problem is that a lot of this material is copyrighted, and of course the RIAA is not going to be happy about that. And Apple may have something to say about it because you're using the iTunes interface, and they definitely do not want you to be able to swap music back and forth across the web via their libraries.
By the way, I predict that this product and company will last about 12.3 seconds.
Well, they've managed to make it 24 hours, and that was 22 hours more than I thought. Because so far, I haven't heard that they've gotten the call from Apple or the RIAA. The difficulty is that it's not that this is impossible to do. It's just more difficult to do using other tools. So it's all just a matter of sharing data across a network. At what point does somebody come in and stop it? Now, again, I think Apple has a chance because they're using the iTunes interface and they've been successful in the past in stopping people from using it. But there are other ways to do this.
So I guess the moral of the story is go to musiccast.org tonight and hope it's still there.
Give it a try. Yeah, it really is a very nice piece of software. And if somebody tells, if Apple or the RIA tells them to cut it out, who knows, maybe it'll go open source. But it's, you just can't stop this stuff. The genie is out of the bottle and people want to do this sort of thing and are going to find a way.
Well, Merlin Mann, you know about a piece of software that does something not quite as revolutionary as MusicCast, but that does allow you to move video to your iPod video. It's a program called iSquint. Why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I played around a little bit with that MusicCast today, and it is very similar to this iSquint in some ways. Yeah, so iSquint, you know, you look at everybody who's out there buying their video iPods, and they're so hungry for new content. And iSquint is a video converter. It takes like AVIs or MPEGs or, you know, DivX or any kind of, almost any kind of non-DRM movie format, and very easily turns it into iPod video, and then can just kind of shunt it straight over onto your iPod for you. And, you know, there's been tools like this out there before, like FFmpegX. There's been a whole bunch of tools like this, but this one is just so drop-dead simple. And for the kind of personality that loves the simplicity of an iPod, this is a real super fast, easy way to do this.
So tell me, I've got a DVD. Could I take this piece of software and move the DVD onto my iPod video?
I think you need some pretty extensive Russian middleware in order to do that. this is really more for, oh gosh, I don't know, if you've got pictures of your kids hitting you in the genitals with a baseball bat or your cat falling off of a couch, this is an easy way to take those AVIs and just scoot them over. Nice thing is it has a queue, so you can grab 5 or 10 of these, throw them in, and then when you wake up in the morning, all this stuff is all moved over for you. Interesting. And another thing that's really been shooting up the charts on Dig and Delicious is something called TubeSock. Have you guys seen this yet?
Yeah, I've used it. It's great.
It's hilarious. So it takes this concept of the way iSquint works, and basically you can point it at any YouTube video, and it will transform that from that .FLV format into an iPod movie format and move it over onto your iPod for you.
Kenji, what about the ability to take stuff like the DVDs we buy and move it into these kinds of software? How much trouble are people having doing that?
It's not necessarily straightforward. And if you're trying to just do it in a, you know, straightforward bashing manner, there are other apps out there to do that. The guys that do iSquint have some other apps out there. I think they were the same ones who did Handbrake Light, which lets you basically just drag a DVD on and pull it off into a iPod ready format.
Well, Merlin, you're well known for being a guy that's sort of an efficiency expert where the web is concerned. Do you think we need to continue to see these software programs get easier and easier and easier before this stuff is really adopted on a wide scale?
Yeah, I think several things would have to happen. I mean, I've just for purely experimental purposes looked at some of these applications, and they're not all intuitively easy to use, and they require a lot of disk space. I mean, if you want to have a big collection of ripped DVDs, you're going to need some serious hard drive space. And then in terms of trading and stuff like that, you know, you need some serious bandwidth. So for the garden variety user, these are not going to be, this is not anything huge to worry about. But I think it was Chris that said it earlier, you know, the genie's out of the bottle with this stuff. You know, in a lot of ways, well, I mean, I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but there's a lot of business opportunities here that people like Apple need to be looking at, because people are so hungry for this content. And providing an easy way for them to grab this stuff and throw it on an iPod is, you know, you're just leaving money on the table.
Speaking of a dead horse, associations like the RIAA, who, by the way, would sue their own mother if they caught them playing a Garth Brooks song twice in a row without a license. I think these people, while purporting to represent the interest of the content creators, have probably done more to keep money out of their pockets than any pirate ever has.
I completely agree. I mean, this is a little off topic, but I think a lot of these companies and organizations are just treading water until they can figure out what the next step is for making money. And, you know, nobody's ever gotten rich by suing their customers that I'm aware of. Maybe they have a plan for that.
Well, let's keep moving. We've been talking about applications. It seems like a theme in this week's show. And Ben, you're a hiker and a photographer. Those two go well together. And you're a GPS user. I am too. And I have been frustrated with my inability to get my Garmin GPS to work with a PC. You found some new stuff that will work with a Mac. What did you find?
Well, Scott, there, of course, the Garmin GPS is shipped with Windows-only software, which has been really annoying for us Mac users who have Garmin GPSs. There are a couple of new products, or one new product and one slightly older product. They're not so great for hiking, but for navigating cities, they let you use your GPS with your Mac. The first is Route Buddy, which is from a British company. Just started shipping a couple weeks ago. You can find it at routebuddy.com. And it lets you use your GPS in conjunction with maps that they provide inside of the Route Buddy software to track your position as you move around town. You see a live map on your Mac and transfer waypoints and do all your tracking data that way.
Well, if Alex Lindsay was here, he'd be screaming about his TomTom about now, which I still marvel at considering the fellow doesn't own an automobile. But for hiking, did you find anything that does work?
Well, the problem with hiking is you want to take some of the cool mapping data that's out there and dump it into your GPS so that you can see the actual little live map on your GPS screen. If you're a Windows user, that's what the Garmin software does. And Garmin sells some incredible mapping data for a very reasonable price. They sell topo maps of the entire country. They sell really high-res topo maps of all the national parks. They're claiming that they're going to have a Mac version of the software available by the end of the year. They claimed that before, so who knows if that will really happen. However, with Bootcamp and Parallels, we now have another option. And I've actually been using the Garmin MapSource software from within Parallels, and it works fine. But with a GPS that actually has a USB adapter, I can run it through Parallels and move all my map data, transfer all my waypoints, and that kind of thing. From a hiking and photography perspective, you know, there are some other products out there that are people have announced that will let you take your GPS and record locations and then tag your photos with them. None of those are shipping yet, although Sony does have something they call the Sony GPS Tracker for photographers, which is a little kind of GPS dongle thing that's supposed to allow you to do some of that kind of stuff.
I really don't understand why this can't simply be built into most of the digital SLRs. It's not that big a deal, and it's a perfect use for a camera. You take a picture, you click a button, you put a GPS waypoint there. It's one of those duh moments for me. I really wish that the camera manufacturers would start thinking a little bit outside the traditional limits of film-based photography, because they've got all this capability there. They're just not using it.
Well, Nikon does that in one of their cameras, don't they?
Yeah, the Nikon D200 will do that, actually. You can hook a GPS in, and as you're shooting your photos, it actually, if you got GPS hooked in, it will record the GPS information into the EXIF data.
And I do think that's cool, but what I think needs to happen beyond that is you simply need to have the ability to record that waypoint right on top of the photograph so that you don't have to have your GPS hooked up.
Right, like the newer, like Verizon cell phones. You've got a small GPS chip in there. And you can walk around with your Verizon phone and use it as a full guidance system.
Yeah, that
so
would
you can
be
do
fun.
The same with the camera.
That would be fun.
One of the nice things about Route Buddy is it gives you a GPS interface to Google Maps and Google Earth. After Route Buddy has identified your location and shown you on its little map, you can then say, "Okay, go show me where I am on Google Earth," and it'll put you right at that spot, which is kind of a cool way of navigating the Google Earth environment.
That's very cool.
And Ben, how does that work on a cruise ship?
I wouldn't know. I was below decks the whole time.
This is a reference to the geek cruises that both Ben and Chris have been on. Chris, I want to talk about what we're doing right now, because one of the emails that I get most often around hosting and being on these podcasts is from people who want to know how we're pulling this off. Right now, we have folks in several cities talking to each other without the use of telephones, over computers using Skype. And we record the Skype signal to create Mac Break Weekly and several of the other shows that a bunch of us are on. Let's talk a little bit about that, because you wrote up a famous Chris Breen Mac 911 piece about this. In case anybody doesn't know, Mac 911 is Chris's answer to Leo's call for help.
Right, in my own little area of the Macworld website and in Macworld magazine. Yeah, because I have been on a lot of these podcasts lately, and more people are using Skype. And if you were actually behind the scenes participating in some of these things, you'd realize what a pain in the neck Skype can be. A lot of times people can get dumped off the line, or you get these weird echoes, or it just things sound funny. And so people have been looking for some kind of solution to get around Skype. It's really pretty good for a one-on-one conference, but once you start adding more bodies to the conference, it gets more difficult. So I was talking about alternate solutions, and one of those is that I've seen people using now is you actually talk by a reliable means, and that can be phone or iChat if that works, or some other voice over IP client, or Skype if you prefer to do it that way. But on each member's end, you're actually recording your own conversation. So you're not having to go through Skype to record anything, but rather each individual records with an audio editor on their machine. And when you're done, then you send the done file to whoever's hosting this thing. So for example, Scott would be editing this one. We'd all record our bits, send it off to Scott, and he would line them up. And the way you do that is at the beginning of the broadcast, the moderator says, okay, everybody on the count of three, one, two, three, and then you all clap, which puts a big audio spike in the middle of it. And Scott, have you actually done this before?
I have. We record TWIM this way, This Week in Media, which is another podcast that I'm involved in and the Kenji's involved in. And we do it a little bit differently. Each person gets on and says their name and then says 3, 2, 1. And then each person successively does the same thing, and then we just line up all the 3, 2, 1s in succession, and it works the same way.
Yeah, so how hard do you find to edit it that way?
It's not hard at all. As soon as you get everybody's 3, 2, 1 figured out, the rest of it flows together very nicely. And the reason we don't use it for some of the podcasts is that it does require some extra equipment. You've got to have a microphone. You've got to have a way to get the microphone into your computer, and it is a little bit more technical for some of the guests that we have that aren't maybe that savvy, so we use the Skype alternative. But having had some of these nightmarish experiences you've discussed, I agree that it might be a very good alternative.
I was just going to say, you also run the risk of if six people are on a call in that fashion, you might get five perfect tracks and then one person who forgot to hit record. And you kind of have wasted the time of six people if it goes wrong for one person.
Right. Yeah, I think in that case, you can do the Skype backup. So at least you have that to fall back on. And also, as you indicate, Scott, if you have guests who are not technically savvy or you don't want to put them through the trouble of that, it is a lot to ask somebody to say, oh, by the way, would you mind recording your end and sending it to me? Some people don't have that kind of time. They just need to get it done and get off the phone. So that leaves you with Skype.
Of course, you realize our opportunity to get a Skype sponsorship is pretty much out the window as a result of this segment.
No, we're just offering gentle encouragement.
It is really quite fantastical that we can even do what we're doing. And on sort of a Dick Tracy watch kind of level, I do think it's very cool. But it isn't acceptable. And what we usually do in a broadcast setting is we'll use what's called a digital telephone hybrid to record people over the telephone. The problem is if you have a group of people like we have here, you have to find a reliable telephone conference line, which is sometimes about as hard to do as finding a reliable Skype connection. Merlin, you proposed an interesting question to me today, and that was, would the next Mac stores be in airports?
Yeah, I stole this idea from a Macworld weblog post by Philip Michaels, and I guess it all started with him being in a situation that we've probably all been in at one time or another, where you forget the cord for your camera, or I'm forever leaving my power supply for my MacBook in various hotel rooms. And he just was saying, this seems like an interesting business opportunity for Apple. What if they started having sort of these small stores or large kiosks inside of major airports? I mean, you got people buying iPods left and right. And I thought that was just kind of a neat idea, and I wanted to hear what other folks might have thought of that idea as well.
Because I'm from Macworld and that Phil has occasional oversight on my work, I think it's a brilliant idea.
Phil and Skype, we love them both.
I do. I love both of them. No, I really do like the idea. I think when iTunes eventually becomes the movie store, there's even more potential here. Imagine being at the airport and being able to jack your iPod into a movie kiosk, for example, and download one of 100 movies they've made available to you for like $9.99. Or if you don't have an iPod, cool, look, there's this $199 video iPod that you could buy, take with you, and it's loaded up with a couple of TV series samples, and then you can add movies to it after that. So I like the idea of there being portable media as well as gear, having the camera cables great, having a power supply is great. Kind of the biggest hits of the stuff you're likely to leave behind, but also something that you can load your iPod with would be great.
Given the fact that we all now have to be at the airport 7.5 hours earlier than our flight, it would probably be cool just to be able to browse Mac gear. The problem I think this idea is going to run into is I absolutely, with all my heart, believe we're moving to a non-carry-on event someday in the future with airplanes, and that's going to kill any kind of retail at the airports.
Well, that's why I want the implantable iPod.
Well, the other thing, the point that I think Phil was making in this that I think is smart is it also about proximity, where if you're like a friend of mine just took off for Ireland and left his PowerBook's power supply here. So where's he going to go? He's not familiar with Dublin. He doesn't know where to go to find that. But if you knew that you could go into the airport and know straight where to go to get it, you know, it wouldn't, you know, just applying kind of 80-20 rule, you could have a pretty good amount of stuff that most users could need in a pretty small footprint, whether or not they could carry it on.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I just don't think in the future they're going to let us carry anything on. In fact, the only reason that they're not making us go on nude is that they've seen me naked. Speaking of iPods, and before we get into something that causes us to lose our clean tag, Chris, there is a changing landscape when it comes to digital music players. There's been a lot of buzz about Microsoft's Zune. And, of course, we heard recently about, and this is not much of a surprise to me, the Dell Diddy taking a dump and dying. Lots of D's in that sentence. What do you know about all that?
Well, yeah, Dell discontinued the DJ Diddy because, one, no buzz. Maybe the music player made a buzz, but there was no buzz about the music player. There was no good way to market the thing because even though Dell does very well online with their computers, people don't go to Dell looking for a music player, because they get an iPod instead. And the other thing that's sort of been failing with all these music players is that there's no good integration with the music service. Whereas the iPod and iTunes are a beautiful match. You get any sort of third-party music player that has to use a Windows system, and you go through these sort of kludgy interfaces, or you go through Windows Media Player, which has just way too much stuff in it. Even, you know, iTunes is a fairly comprehensive program as well, but it seems easier to get around in it, whereas Windows Media Player seems like they've got everything in there, plus a little more, and then just a little more to make it more complicated. And then you try to jack a music player into it as well and get your media onto the player, and it's just an unholy mess. So that hasn't benefited Dell and many of the third parties.
What about the Zune? Have you heard today's reports that it's not everything it's cracked up to be?
Well, actually, it's everything that a Toshiba 1098 is cracked up to be, because that's what it is. It's a Toshiba 1098 music player, basically. It's a 30-gigabyte hard drive, FM tuner, 3-inch screen. You can share music supposedly with up to 4 other people who have these things. It's made out of plastic, and it's $300, but there are a few problems with it. One, the click wheel isn't a click wheel. Instead, it's just a round interface with buttons on it, and so there's no real scroll wheel on there. The wireless capabilities sound cool, but it actually requires that somebody else within hailing distance of you owns one of these things. So, you know, if you don't sell a bunch of them, you're the one person standing around with the Zune saying, "Hey, anybody want to share with me?" And they're all listening to their iPods going, "Loser." And then there's that integration problem again. So this is just another Windows kind of MP3 player. And if there's not a good service, if Microsoft isn't offering something as compelling as iTunes, then you've got a not-so-great player working with a not-so-great music service, and why buy it?
Merlin, what's it going to take for somebody to crack the iPod's dominance? And I do mean dominance of this space.
You know, I really have no idea. I oscillate between these two poles. On the one hand, I think, well, gosh, you know, I really want devices that do one thing really well. I mean, more and more people I know are out there now buying a phone that's just a phone, and they don't want it to do all these things. I just got a Trio, and it plays music, and I don't want any of that stuff, you know? So, I mean, on the one hand, there's this interesting convergence devices that are doing all this stuff really well. And then, you know, I think Chris put it really well. I mean, the iPod just works so well with the Mac. And it still amazes me that I go out and I buy a new camera or I buy a new printer and I plug it in and the icon pops up. And I've been on Mac since 1987, and that still amazes me. So, I mean, if you can get that kind of lockstep integration, you know, people get really attached.
Yeah, I think until you get something that competes with the iTunes Music Store, it doesn't matter what your player looks like. I say it over and over and over again. It's all in the iTunes Music Store. Unless it hooks up to the iTunes Music Store, you'll never sell it. Let's move on. Kenji, I want you and I to cover this because, you know, I don't know anything about hacking, and I'm sure you don't, but we can both talk about this. The MacBook hack controversy turns out to be, wait for it, a hoax.
Yeah.
It wasn't real.
Yeah, there's been a lot of reports circulating around about this. If you got to see the original video where they were talking about how they used a, I think it was a Dell laptop to hack into a MacBook wirelessly. The system they hacked into was supposedly using a third-party wireless card, using a third-party driver on this MacBook. It's turning out that this probably was a faked or at least a very crafted demonstration to make it look like these guys had some information about hacking into other systems wirelessly.
The bottom line was they pretended to hack into a MacBook, and that would be based on everybody's traditional MacBook user experience, which is to rely on the wireless that comes with the MacBook. And what they actually did was work through a third-party card, so it was no big deal.
Yeah. And, I mean, if they had hacked it through the built-in wireless and had kind of put up how they'd done that, I think it would have given more credence, but they didn't do that. You know, it's becoming very clear that this probably was kind of a hoax or a total faked kind of situation.
You guys think that Apple's beating its chest lately via its new commercials about its ability to avoid viruses and such is inviting these sorts of attacks?
It's a good question. Didn't David Pogue's thing in the New York Times this week? He had a kind of an inspired rant about a Gruber-esque rant about the idea that Macs actually really are more secure, that it isn't simply a matter of, you know, the virus writers are looking for the biggest market out there. And I mean, I don't have enough insight to say whether that's accurate or not, but it's, I don't know. I mean, are we getting 5% of the viruses that are out there? It doesn't seem like it.
No, in fact, I don't get any viruses, thank you very much, because I don't have Parallels or Boot Camp on my MacBook Pro.
But there is one thing to think about.
That's why they hate us.
Well, you do have to be careful, though, because I mean, I know I get into the habit of getting used to typing in my password because I've got my security pretty locked down. But you get so used to typing that in habitually that you maybe don't always check what process is looking to change. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you get into this habit where, you know, if you're constantly entering your password, it loses the power.
I think we're going to continue to see attacks on this level, and somebody may eventually crack through the Macs. And if they do, all that'll end up accomplishing is forcing Apple to make them better.
Well, and I think that the one area which kind of gets overlooked sometimes is just general Wi-Fi security. I mean, even though this situation of hacking into a MacBook remotely using another system is looking like it's probably fake, general Wi-Fi security, people don't always realize that, you know, using a web password or Mac filtering is not secure. I mean, if you look at some of the Wi-Fi software, even on a Macintosh, you can scan pretty easily past WEP and MAC filtering.
Kenji, also want to talk about Intel's new chip. How do you say this? Murrum?
I think so.
Murrum.
Unless somebody else wants to clarify that. Yeah, their new chip Intel announced on Monday is the new, basically, Core 2 Duo, which people have kind of been waiting for. And it's looking like it's a pretty cool chip.
Now, this is the new version of the chip that we've already seen, the Core Duo. This is the Core 2 Duo. Now, my first question is, why not call it the Core Duo 2?
Good question. Someone in marketing might want to rethink the way they're naming stuff. So.
I've read that it is much faster, but it does require more power, which immediately gets me concerned about that little hot spot in my MacBook Pro getting even hotter.
Well, I think they announced not just their high-end one, but also a lower performance, lower-end chip that was actually designed for notebooks specifically. So instead of, I think, the 2.16 gigahertz to 2.33 gigahertz range, it's a 1.8 gigahertz. chip designed for notebooks.
Will we see enough performance boost there to justify that over the existing 2.16 core Duo that we have now?
I think tests will have to be done, and we'll see then whether this is really going to give us that performance boost that people are expecting it will.
Chris Breen, do you have any inside information on this?
Not a smidgen.
Not a smidgen. Well, if you don't know, then nobody knows. I have seen the test they did on the PCs, and they said that the gaming performance was actually somewhat slower. I found that interesting.
I think it's a 64-bit chip versus 32-bit now.
Mm-hmm.
Someone might want to correct me on that if I'm wrong, but that could be part of the reason why you're seeing a slowdown potentially. So,
well, at least they continue to develop new stuff, and we'll always look forward to getting the newest thing. You know, the joke is you go to the Mac store and you walk in and you say, I want to see the new MacBook Pro. And the guy goes, no, you don't. And you go, no, I want to see the new MacBook Pro. Really? Okay. No, you don't. Yes, I want to see the new MacBook Pro. He goes, no, you want to see the next new MacBook Pro. Well, we've covered a lot of ground for this show. Lots of stuff happening. And before we go, just want to ask everybody to tell me what's going on. Chris Breen, what do you got going on? Where can people find out more about what you're into?
They can always go to macworld.com/mac911, which is my tips and troubleshooting section of Macworld. Otherwise, go to playlistmag.com and tune into the iPod blog where I rant Tuesdays and Thursdays every week.
Oh, something to look forward to. Ben Long, tell us real quick about your new Aperture book.
I got two new Aperture books out. I've got the Apple Pro Training Aperture book, which I wrote with Orlando Luna. And I have a book called Real World Aperture, which is on shelves now at your local bookstore.
Both good books. I've read them both. Thanks very much for being on the show. Merlin Mann from 43 Folders. How does it feel to run one of the most popular blogs in the universe?
Why you gotta say that? Why you gonna make me feel all bad?
Because it's true. You're in the Technorati top 100. It's like,
dude, that's just me reloading it all day long. That's literally just me. It's me. Okay, it's me and my mom. All right. So are you happy? You know, she's an old lady. So
I've been doing it too. So I'm helping.
It's 43folders.com, 43folders.com. And yeah, it's time management, productivity, life hacks, and lots of ways to productively waste your time.
Very good blog. I read it religiously. Kenji, what are you into that you can talk about legally?
Lots of different things. Working with PixelCore on doing a lot of this kind of podcasting stuff. And I've got some side projects of my own company I'm working on. Along with some additional work I do in graphics area for a company called HDR VFX. Does some interesting graphics stuff for 3D renderings and so forth. So.
You are an impressive group of guys, and I'm proud to share the podcast mic with you. My name's Scott Bourne, and I am filling in for the hardest working man in podcasting, Leo Laporte. He'll be back soon, we promise. In the meantime, you can find me over at my regular podcast with Chris Breen and Derek Story called The iLife Zone. Until next week, this has been episode 4 of MacBreak Weekly. Thank you very much for tuning in.